want to record it. So, I mean, everything I say can be used against me, and I'm kind of worried about that, I would say. Yeah, close it off. So this will be a continuation of, so this is part of this grad course Andrew Tom started and Chris Phillips continued, and he will continue next Tuesday. And as I have these two times, and where the topic is purely into C-file bias, and I 2 weeks ago I talked about it and gave some elementary properties of purely implicit C-style bias. And let me just remind a little bit about these things. For one, we have a definition. We say, and keep in mind that I'm most interested in the non-simple case. So C-style bias generally here are non-simple. So A is purely infinite, abbreviated to PI. If A has no quotients, it has quotient, but it has no abelian quotient. That is the same as saying it doesn't have any character. And if A set of positive element one has that if A belongs to the closed two-sided ideal generated by B, then it follows that A less than B in the sense of Kunz, and I can also remind you about that one. We say A less than or equal to B if and only if they exist a sequence of elements in A such that xn star B xn tends to A. And the reason for having this property here is that, for example, an abelian C-star algebra would always satisfy this thing here. We definitely don't want that to be purely infinite. And also, there's an analog of the requirement for purely infinite simple C-style bias that they be not the complex numbers. Then we also defined last time that if A is a positive element, then we say that A is properly infinite. Maybe I also abbreviate that to P, maybe I just abbreviate that to P inf. It's not that really very good because that would also be P inf. Maybe prop I is probably better. But yeah, I haven't said much in. Properly infinite if you double A, then that is less than equivalent to A. And that is really saying that if I take this element in the 2x2 matrices, then that is less than or equal to this 2x2 matrix. I hope you can see apart my A's and my zeros, and maybe also this might be in the way. Is it missing here? Maybe I put this up. So I mean, well, this really belongs to the 2x2 matrices, and this here belongs to the 1x1 matrices, but somehow we can think of everything as belonging to the same matrix algebra by passing to the largest one that contains them both. This extends the notion of proper infiniteness of projections. And then we have a theorem, and this is something I also discussed last time, saying that A is purely infinite if and only if all positive A in A are properly infinite. And one has some permanence properties also. Pi is closed under ideals quotients extensions inductive limits we will take a stable equivalence, let's call it that, so that actually means that you have two stably equivalent or isomorphic C-style algebras and one is purely infinite, then so is the other. So in particular it passes to matrix algebras and hereditary sub-algebras. One thing, since we don't know, is cross products. Actually, I really thought about this yesterday evening or this morning, I forget which, and I think it was this morning, we somehow blurred together, and I think it is unknown. I'm definitely sure there's not a theorem saying it, but I just remember, I cannot for sure remember if there's a counterexample. And a cross product, it could also be by what group, but say by set, but really, I would imagine any other. Well, I mean, I guess you cannot, it has to be a discrete group. For sure, if you take continuous groups, then there'll be counterexamples for sure. So it should be by discrete groups. Tensor products I will address later. That's really a very delicate issue, and I think it deserves some special mention. And so there are both positive and negative results for tensor products, which are quite interesting. Let me, where's that? Oh yeah, and also let me remind you of a definition. We say that tau is a trace on A if tau goes from A plus. It is only defined on the positive elements, and I allow the value plus infinity. And tau satisfies the trace property. So tau is additive, and homogeneous. And has a trace property. And then I also want tau to be lower semi-continuous. Since we don't have a normalized trace, non-continuity is no longer guaranteed, so we need some amount of continuity. So we assert lower semi-continuity. And that is preserves upwards limits, like in the theorem of Lebesgue's monotone convergence theorem. And actually, I will also sometimes, even without mentioning, weaken this and also allow for quasi-traces. In the exact case, that would be the same thing as what we have here. And the quasi-traces differ by traces simply by the additivity. The additivity is only for commuting elements. And then, in that case, for technical reasons, you also have to ask that tau extends to the 2x2 matrices. And we say that tau is non-degenerate if there exists some A in A positive element whose value is neither 0 nor infinity. So degenerate traces only take the values 0 and infinity. And any C algebra has degenerate traces. You can simply just, on some ideals, you put it to be 0, and on all other ones, you have the value plus infinity. And regarding these things, so I'm more or less done with the repetition of this state. For the last time, I mentioned and also argued the following, that if we have a C algebra who tends to solely absorb over infinity, then we can prove it is purely infinite. And if it is purely infinite, then A is traceless. And that means that A has only, or has no non-degenerate trace. That is what it means to be traceless. And in some sense, the whole study of being purely infinite was motivated by trying to characterize non-simple C algebras with this property here. And on the other hand, in that investigation, I mean, this property here really seems also quite appealing. It seems natural also to try to understand what these three transpirers look like, those who are traceless. In a perfect world, we like all of these to be the same. As you will see shortly, we have results that say that under additional hypotheses, we would have such theorems. But in general, this will not be true. So before stating that result, somehow relating these, studying the reverse implications, we need more properties. And this is somehow where the theory gets a little bit unpleasant in some way, because we have this somehow, in my eyes, nice definition of being purely infinite, given as a breakaway, and I think in particular this notion that a proper infiniteness of positive elements is somehow very stringent and appealing, and the two are the same and all is well, and we have pretty good permanence properties. But it turns out that if you want to somehow relate tracelessness to an algebraic property, you don't quite get pure infiniteness, you get something that I will define shortly calling weak pure infiniteness. And even for that you have to pass to an ultra power. And somehow if you want to go from being purely infinite to this property here, on the other hand you need a somewhat stronger property called strong purely infinite. And they may all be the same, we just don't know. So I mean, now I will define some of these other properties, and we'll talk a little bit about them. Right. So we say that so if n is a natural number, then we say that A is a PIN if for all. It can be defined different ways, but I will stick to this notion that came from a paper by Eberhard and myself. For all positive elements A and A, if you amplify A n times, and this I will also denote A tensor 1n, this one is properly infinite. So it says that for every positive element, some amplification of it is probably infinite. And the crucial thing is that the amplification, the size of the amplification should be a universal number that works for the whole series algebra. So if you could let n depend on A, that would be a completely different property. Way weaker than this one here. Right, and somehow the converse of being PIN for any n is that for every n you can find an element so that if you amplify it that many times, it is not properly infinite. This is somehow a useful thing to have in mind. We also say that A is weakly purely infinite, abbreviated WPI, if A is PIN for some n. And I will also come back to how relations of this and how things fit together. Then we also have a notion of locally purely infinite. Maybe just take that right away. And that is, if I'll just write it out in words, if every hereditary sub-C-star algebra of A is generated as an ideal by its stable sub-C-star algebras. If you have, let me just write that down. If you have K and L are natural numbers, say K greater than, or L greater than K, if A tensor 1K dominates A tensor 1L, then A tensor 1K is probably infinite, and hence will dominate any other power. and it goes both ways. Right, so so this property says that you have tons of stable sub-C's, I suppose. It's a little bit technical, I will not address it too much at this very moment, but I'll come back to it briefly later. And then we have the strong version. We say that A is strongly purely infinite. And so this is a very useful condition, and it's not a, well, I don't know if it's a very unpleasant definition, maybe it looks a little bit funny, but it's really the one that easily connects you to this property here. So it says the following. Whenever you have a positive 2x2 matrix, there exists a diagonal matrix for all positive epsilon also. So if you have two things, a positive epsilon and a positive 2x2 matrix, then you can find a diagonal matrix so that if you compress by that diagonal matrix, then you almost get to the diagonal. And here I hope you can distinguish my zeros and my Z's. So you compress this one and then you get to the diagonal. And so this is called the matrix diagonalization property. No. What? Yeah. Right. I'm going to say these are zeros and these are series. Yeah. That's right, yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, this only makes sense in a 2x2 matrix algebra, doesn't it? The statement. Let me mention one thing that will come into the following, just to get a little bit feel for this one here. Yeah, I'm afraid it might be. I will prove a number of easy implications and I will write down some more statements, but let me just at this point give you this one here. Assuming that A has a unit, it doesn't really make a big difference if it does, it's just slightly easier. In that case, if you have this thing here, then you have an asymptotically central sequence of mappings from O infinity into A, universal star homomorphisms. So that phi n x A tends to zero for all x in O infinity and for all A in A. And in that case, you can simply you have the following, that if you take two isometries, any two for that matter, not any two, but say the two first canonical isometries, or any two isometries who has orthogonal ranges in O infinity, and you look at this diagonal here, and then you take any 2x2 matrix, and then you do this again, then this converges to the diagonal. So I mean, this may be one somehow exercise in applying the property of being strongly purely infinite. Good, and I should also make a small notation. A infinity, in contrast to O infinity, I will be the power. This following power of A. You look at all infinity, all bounded sequences, marginal sequences that tend to zero. So let me just say L infinity of A is a set of sequences where A belongs to A and supremum norm of An is finite, and C naught of A but here where norm of An tends to zero, and this is an ideal in L infinity of A. So looking at this quotient is a very useful and handy thing. One can also define it not just for this ideal here, but you can also consider for every filter or free filter on A, you can consider convergence along a specific filter. That could be particularly pertinent for ultra filters, but we don't really need it here, so I'll just stick with this A infinity. And then let me then write down a theorem by Kirchberg and myself. That relate these properties to each other. So A is a well, N is equal to then we can look at various properties. We can look at one saying that A is isomorphic to A tend to infinity. We can look at a property saying A is strongly purely infinite. We've already seen that this holds. Then we can look at the property that A is purely infinite. I will also show this one here. We can take the property that A is weakly purely infinite. Then we can take the property that A infinity, well, let me just say infinity is traceless, and then the property that A is traceless. So these are somehow properties that are weaker and weaker as we move to the right. Actually, these are equivalent. So that's the only theorem where we have where it goes the other way, in full generality. And this is also why weakly purely infinite is an interesting property, that it relates to being traceless in this way. That is missing here, this limit algebra. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's actually also the same as this one being weakly purely infinite. And then in the other direction, let me, here I have to put, they don't hold in general, so let me just put numbers on it. It's because, well, it is simply because I am teaching I allow for quasi traces. I allow for quasi traces. So in this definition of being traceless, I must allow for quasi traces. And if you don't like them, then take. I somehow said that, but slipped it also a little bit underneath the carpet, and but is it? No, I'm happy with them. I feel good about them. I would think so. Bruce is the one to ask him there. So if you look at some of the remaining implications, then here's what we can say. We know that one holds if A is nuclear and separable. So this is not very much to ask for, and not in general. And I will come back to why that is the case. Two holds if A is either simple or field rank zero or say approximately divisible or C absorbing for that matter. Why do we say that? If it is, so this is in a way weaker than being approximately divisible. And there could even be more. Three is the same, but also if global prim halving holds. And I will come back to that later. So that is yet another property that will also guarantee it. So if there's one of these many properties, then it's fine. And this one I have not defined yet, but I will come back to it later. So that is somehow the most tricky one, that holds if A is approximately divisible or C-stable, and also a little bit more generally stable under other tensor products as well. And this is not in general, this one here, good. So here we have counterexample and here we have counterexample. So if I take the counterexamples in four, then I myself found they exist a simple nuclear separable unital C for algebra A, such that A is finite and M2 of A is infinite. Well, there's a simple unital simple C for algebra that has both a finite and infinite potential. It can be phrased differently. Now, if M2 of A is infinite, so A is simple and not stably finite, like if a matrix algebra over this infinite, then it's not stably finite, this implies that A is traceless. So it has no traces other than the trivial one, which is zero or infinity. Only values you can take, and if A is finite, then A is not purely infinite. It's a little bit tricky about, by finite I mean that the unit of A is finite projection, and actually one cannot conclude from this that it is weakly, that it is not weakly purely infinite. I mean, I will come back to that also, but this one we can conclude for sure. And but then in presence of simplicity, it will imply that A is not really purely infinite by simplicity. So hence we have a C algebra that satisfies the condition to the right, but not purely infinite, and hence something must go wrong along the way. And that shows that this implication doesn't hold. So we know that if we take the asymptotic sequence C algebra here, then this is not traceless. So there is actually a trace on this asymptotic sequence algebra. Yeah, I mean, I cannot say what it looks like, but I would somehow imagine, I mean, I will also explain at some point how you get from really purely, I mean, how you get from being traceless to being really purely infinite, and maybe that will somehow explain it better, that you can really use some properties related to the to pure infiniteness. Yeah, that's what I mean all the time, yeah. Okay, so that was as far as that counterexample goes, and here Dijkhammer and myself, and also independently or later Kirchberg, have produced examples of along the line that if you take choose a universal seed enterprise and equip them with some suitable states and take the reduced free product, then in many, many cases this will be simple, and it has typically no central sequences. So then somehow these three products, also if you look somehow to the weak closure, they are characterized by either gamma or non-gamma always. Okay, I think it is property gamma. They have saying that they have no non-trivial central sequences. And if they have no central sequences, then they cannot absorb infinity. So let me call this C-Salzbar fracture A, and so typically you will have that it does not absorb infinity, at least in most cases. And also this thing here is purely infinite if phi or psi is not a trace, again in most cases. This is somehow just to give a general feeling for it, and then you can write down explicit examples where it is the case. Let me just say here that if both these are traces, then this one here has a trace. So this one also comes with a canonical state, and this state is a trace if both of these is a trace. Yes? You're right. Thank you. So explicitly, this is what Kirsberg did. I mean, I think that is quite nice. I've not read it, but I believe him. It sounds very plausible. This one here is even strongly purely infinite, and not infinity absorbing, and it is simple also if phi is not a trace. I think also we need phi to be faithful. Generally, if you take free products but it is not faithful, you can get into trouble. And it's reduced, yes. Thank you. So I mean, this is somehow a typical situation where this appears, and note that these examples typically are exact. I mean, if A and B are exact, then so is that free product. So we ask for nuclearity, and we cannot relax it to exactness. Then I would like to give some indications of proofs. I mean, I only take somehow the easy ones. I mean, those that is not typical, just somehow you get a feeling for how these definitions play together. And let me take one, which is relatively easy to see. This one here, one more that involves the property of strong pure infiniteness, I mean that property here. So for this one, what we do is we take a positive element. I want to prove this property infinite, and I also take a positive epsilon. Then using this strongly pure infinite, I can find D1 and D2 and A, so that if I try to diagonalize this matrix, or I can diagonalize this matrix approximately, so for every epsilon I can find such a diagonal doing this, and I don't even need it to be a diagonal for this particular purpose. Hence, I get, let me try to write it down, I have here, that if I double A, this is the same as this element by definition, and then if we just look to the definition of Kuhn's comparison, we see that this is then less than or equal to this matrix here. And here I don't need it to be diagonal, just any matrix. And now this one here is equivalent to this matrix, and this just follows by taking x to be a to the 1 half, a to the 1 half, 0, 0, then x star x to this one, and x, x star is the other one. Did I get it right? No. I got it wrong. This is better, can you? This is better, isn't it? No? Yeah, this is better. And this one is equivalent, or let's just say less than equivalent to A 0, 0, 0, which is, say, equivalent with A. So here it says that A is probably infinite. Well, and then I would like to explain briefly how you go from being how you go from being traceless to being weakly purely infinite. And of course, that is the same thing as saying that A is not really purely infinite, imply has a non-degenerate trace. So assuming that, we have to remember that if D is a say a state, well not a state, shouldn't be an additive functional on the consonant group W of A. And that basically means it is this is something as saying D is a dimension function. And in a way also, let me just, since I'm at it, say it is really the same thing as saying that we just have a map from positive matrices into 0 to infinity included that respects orthogonal sum. And such that A less than equal to B implies D of A less than D of B. So anyways, if you have such one here, then one to that can associate a new function D bar of A, which is going to be the limit as epsilon tends to zero from the right of D of the epsilon cut down of A, like this.
Why do you have to go through A00A? Why not just say that 2A is the same as A?
I was just emphasizing.
Right.
I was just emphasizing that 2A and A are the same.
But that's true in any C0.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with
vertices. No. I mean, just because I wanted to emphasize that. I mean, these are somehow equivalent in a certain canonical way.
Yeah.
And then 2A and A are the same.
A0, 0A.
What?
Yeah, maybe.
Oh!
while about that here. Sorry. Sorry.
Yeah, it will, yeah, it depends on what this quality time is. Yeah, it depends on the meaning of equal, yeah. Yeah, sorry about that. Anyway, I'm just making a point here about how you get to how you get to places, and so I'm just saying, if you have an additive function, I mean, one who does this, then it may not be quite good enough, but then you can rectify it this way, and then it becomes lower semi-continuous. One of the bad things about this one is that supposing this is non-degenerate, then it could happen that this one suddenly is degenerate. So that is somehow some, I mean, a really serious extra problem that one has to look out for. So it could somehow be that this is either dead zero or infinity at all values. It's kind of a tricky thing. From d bar, one can then form a trace tau given by integration. Where you take the key cut down of A and integrate. And this thing here is a quartic trace. A lower semi-continuous quartic trace. I mentioned this actually last time, I just want to repeat it. So I mean, at least from some point of view, all we have to do is to find an additive functional on the continuum group, or one who does this. And then we have to worry about this problem also. I will not get too much into that, but it's definitely a problem. Oh, sorry, normal A. I mean, it could go all the way up to infinity, it doesn't really matter. But it ends there anyway. Yeah, sorry for my handwriting. Right, and now in order to get this, what we do is we need to find an element A such that, let me just write it exactly as I have here, if I can find it. Right, such that for all k and l in n, one has that a tends to 1 k less than a tends to 1 l implies k less than l. And this is the same as saying that for all k in n, a tensor 1k is not properly infinite, related to Kent's question for some time ago. Now, if we can do that, then this will imply that there exists a d dimension function such that d of a is equal to 1, simply by some more or less abstract nonsense extension, Hahn-Banach type extension result. I mean, basically we can see that on this it will make good sense to define d of a to be 1. It will not violate, at least from how the most obvious elements, there will be no violations of the of these properties here. And then it follows that you can extend it. Actually, in order to circumvent this problem here, you have to do a little bit more. I mean, you have to make certain epsilon cut down, so you have to refine this a little bit. So it doesn't quite do it. But let me say, I mean, it's quite easy now how to find this element. Because if A is not really purely infinite, then for each n and m, there exists a n times the element, we can take it to be of norm 1, such that a n amplified n times is not properly infinite.
then we can put A to be the element obtained by just taking a sequence, this sequence of elements, and then add the ideal to get an element in L infinity of A mod C naught of A, which is A infinity.
And this element will have its desired properties.
So they haven't quite solved it because of this problem here, but that can be taken care of by some extra arguments. So I think this will be a good time to take a break, 10-minute break.
So I guess it's time to begin again. Okay, and let me just see. And the next thing I will address are things related to local computing. I actually forgot to write that down. That was a bit annoying. It sits local computing that sits here, and it implies being traceless. It may also imply this thing here. I just didn't check it. But let me just put it like this. And let me make one remark. We can also make a definition. If there is any C algebra, then I can look at an ideal PI for proper infinite, which is a closed two-sided ideal generated by proper infinite elements in A. So the closed two-sided ideal is generated by those. And it is a fact that if A is locally purely infinite, when this ideal is all away. The opposite implication is not true. And let me get it right. It also a fact that if we have a positive element in this ideal, and we have a positive epsilon, then they exist properly infinite positive elements in A, such that if we take the epsilon cut down of A, then that is dominated by the sum of these properly infinite elements. Actually, it also implies, or does it say that this holds for every hereditary sub-C algebra of A. And this is because being a hereditary sub-C algebra, I mean, being locally purely infinite passes to, by definition, to locally to hereditary sub-C algebras. Hence, if A is locally purely infinite, A is a positive element, and epsilon is positive, then we can find properly infinite element in the hereditary sub-C algebra generated by A, such that A minus epsilon is less than the sum of these probably infinite elements, and since they belong to this hereditary sub-algebra, their sum is less equal to A. Call this element B. And now we have a question I raised last time. Last time I forgot the application of it, and now I can tell you. Suppose that A and B are positive and probably infinite. Does this imply that the sum is probably infinite? Let me say it is okay, trivially so, if A and B are orthogonal to each other. So it is open even when they commute. And still an interesting question in that case. So the sum of two properly infinite elements, is that again properly infinite? If yes, then B is properly infinite.
where B is that element from here. And in that case, we have that the epsilon cut down of A doubled is less than or equal to B, the red sum itself. B was probably infinite, so that is less than B, and B was less than A. And if this holds for all epsilon, then one can conclude that A is probably infinite. Hence, conclusion is, if question has affirmative answer, then locally purely infinite is the same as weak pure infinite is the same as purely infinite. And even for to reach this conclusion, there's also a way of relaxing this question where asking more than A and B are properly infinite, we can also ask them to be what is called stately properly infinite, meaning that every epsilon cut down is properly infinite. So we can ask more for A and B, but just ask the same conclusion. So that would be a weaker question. That is, that would also imply this conclusion here. So it's a very curious problem, and I mean, certainly both Eberhard and Etienne and I have been thinking hard about it, and that shouldn't exclude any of you. Yeah, that's what Eberhard seemed to mention, that it had a bearing on it, except I couldn't quite work out the implications. And okay. yeah, let me also, so, I mean, the big question somehow is if these are the same in general, and strong pure infinite also. We have, there is a curious theorem saying that if A is weakly purely infinite, when the multiplier about A is weakly purely infinite. And it's a question if the same holds for purely infinite. But again, I mean, this is somehow the reason why we have these different notions. One notion can do one thing for you and others do other things for you. Another fact is that weakly purely infinite is the same as purely infinite if and only if all unital weakly purely infinite C star algebras are infinite. And that is infinite in the sense of just having an infinite prediction, that a unit is infinite. And one way of getting that is actually using this result here, that you pass the multiplier algebra with this unit, so, and it suffices to take that this one here is infinite. So I mean, this is in some sense, I mean, in my eyes, I mean, it seems it is a curious thing. I mean, you have, I mean, a weakly purely infinite C-star algebra. I mean, satisfying this property as a unit. I mean, then just prove the unit is an infinite projection. I mean, but it's, yeah, we have not been able to do it, and it's completely open. I mean, it sounds in a way like it should be true, but there's also maybe a tendency that if a problem has been open for a sufficiently long time, and there's no real obvious reason why it should be true, then probably it's false. And there's something to be said. Interesting point. Interesting. But maybe there was a good reason why that should be true. I mean, who knows? And let me at this point give what you might call an example, but it's somehow also, this is in a way an implication of this theorem. Look at the following C's algebra. So we look at the cone, well, we close it up at the right end point, it doesn't really matter. And it actually looks like this one here. This one we call an A8 pseudo-algebra. It's really an A8 algebra, but A8 algebras are typically assumed to be unital. So these are locally compact spaces, so let me call that one A8 naught. And we also need, in order to define the mappings, a dense subset of the interval. So we pick that one. That is required for our definition of the mappings, because then we define phi n of a function here that goes to a or here for that matter, it goes to a matrix twice the size, and we just let it be this one here. And here we take the max of T and Tn. So this is max of T and Tn. Right, so this was actually considered also by a student, Jakob Mortensen, many years ago, in 1994 or something like that. That was doing the first field a year, 1994, 1995. Was it for? There wasn't a 4 and 5, I think it was. let me say that for each T interval, you can associate an ideal of A characterized by, if you cut it down by one of the algebras along the way, then it is equal to functions vanishing from T and onwards. So there is, by coherency of the mappings, an ideal doing this thing here for each T. And moreover, the ideal lattice of A is precisely this. So all ideals are of this form, only these ideals. And as a lattice, as an ordered set, this is the same as the interval, so in particular this is totally ordered. That it may be in some sense be said to be the next best thing after being simple, that the ideal lattice is totally ordered. So we have a curious fact about this one that relates to our theorem, that A is traceless. And of course that relates very much to the ideal structure, because a trace somehow is defined on an algebraic ideal, you have complete control over those, and simply by the way these mappings are put together, you cannot have a trace in this one. But another fact, well, so if you want to apply this theorem, now we have a traceless C algebra, and a way I want to go all the way to the left. And I can do that. Well, I'm simple and nuclear, that is fine, but I need a little bit more. I mean, the approximate visibility would be nice. As it turns out, it is automatic. But let us, one can prove that it is approximate divisible, but let us assume we don't want to prove it. Then we can just even replace A by A tensor, the algebra. And that would not really change with the induction limit very much, but it is even unnecessary. Then, if we do that, then by the theorem we get that A is isomorphic to A tensor over infinity, and A is purely infinite. So in other words, we can get a purely infinite C algebra arising as an A naught algebra, which somehow is a little bit counterintuitive, because one would think that these look very finite. But nonetheless, in this way we get a purely infinite C algebra. There is one application of this. Yeah, but even this doesn't, as it turns out. Or it turns out by O2, there's also O2 observing.
Well, of course, if there's no thing in there, then the potential way O2 and infinity is not going to change it now.
Mm-hmm. And new...
Oh, this is about K0 into rational diagram. Well, in fact, it's not this table, so it doesn't change.
Hmm.
I'm only saying this, if you couldn't be bothered to prove it is a pattern divisible, then you could just do this.
You would have that
problem. But it's also, you could also prove directly that it is isomorphic. So we can get a new proof of a theorem of Wisawa saying that if B is separable and exact, then the cone over B is AF embeddable. It basically into an AF algebra. A very surprising result. And the way you can now prove it is that you take the cone over B, which is C naught of the half open interval tensor B. And now B is separable and exact, so that embeds into O2 by Kirchberg's theorem. And O2 embeds non-unitarily into O infinity. And this one definitely embeds into our algebra A. And this is all A. So the cone over B embeds into this particular algebra we have up there. And this one embeds into an A of algebra. All A8 algebras and all A8 naught algebras embed into A of algebras. It is not hard to see, and you can even choose a very specific one. Can be chosen, let me just say nicely. It can definitely not be simple. You can certainly not choose a simple AF algebra here, but you can choose one whose ideal lattice is totally ordered and which is homeomorphic to the Cantor set. This actually led Descartes and I to prove the following result. So in a sense, it is a little bit, I mean, it was first surprising to us that purely the C algebras can arise in this way, but we can almost characterize algebras of this type here in the following theorem. Supposing that A is a strongly purely infinite C algebra which is nuclear and separable. And suppose also, and what I'm going to write down now is what we call A is homotopic to zero in an ideal preserving way. And I'll write down exactly what it means. That there exists phi t and the morphisms of A for each t in the interval such that the mapping t goes to phi t of A is continuous for all A in A. Phi 1 is the identity, phi 0 is 0, and such that for every ideal in A, one has that phi t of I is contained in I. So that's ideals into themselves. Then we can conclude the following two things. For one thing, we can conclude that A is isomorphic to A tensor the compact and tensor O2. And this follows from Kirchberg's, at least the O2 thing follows from Kirchberg's classification theorem, because you can prove that under these conditions it is KK equivalent to O2 to this algebra here. And the second thing is that we have a structure theorem of A. A is an inductive limit of algebras of the form a matrix algebra over C naught of gamma J, V J, where gamma J is a one-dimensional graph, I guess that is saying the same thing twice, and V J is an element in gamma J, and by that I mean that these are continuous functions on the graph that vanish at this point. So in other words, A can be written as something that looks pretty much like what we have up there. And so this way we have, just assuming strongly purely infinite nuclearity and separability, and of course this pretty strong condition, we can write as an inductive limit.
Then you have
Oh, yeah, the totally ordered.
Well, yeah. not
only
totally ordered,
but exactly the only one. Yeah, okay, yeah. No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right, I mean, yeah, this thing has been around, that's for sure, yeah. Okay, I was wondering if I should do some study. I think I would like to insert a small remark about the global clip halving. Maybe I put it. Yeah. Actually, what Morton did was he took that example I wrote down and I just deleted and tensored with O2 and proved the classification system of that. And what we can show now is that he didn't even need to tensor it by O2, which was sort of a surprise. Let me mention a fact that goes back to Glynn, saying a C tiles bar A, so if it's a C tiles bar, then A is non-abelian if and only if there exists a start motion from the cone over M2 into A, which is non-zero. And I mentioned that before, and one of the problems with this, I mean, it's very, very nice result and a kind of a really beautiful proof too. And some of the problem is that you cannot say anything about the size of the image. And so one question we have, which is a global game halving, as the following, supposing a little bit more than this, suppose A has no finite dimension quotient. Does it follow that there exists a map phi star morphism from the cone over M2 into A such that the image of phi is full in A, meaning that the image is not containing a proper closed two-side ideal? And you can even relax it a little bit. I will not do that here. You even actually only need to address it for unison algebras, that would be sufficient. It turns out, I mean, that somehow the minimal condition on A would be that it has no that all quotients are at least two-dimensional. I mean, that would somehow be the minimal assumption, and we can prove that that minimal assumption is not enough. You can somehow make a continuous field where the fibers are 2x2 matrices, the way this fails. But if you make them 3x3 matrices, then I have no example. So, I mean, you need a little bit more than the minimal assumption. Here you need only the minimal, but here for sure you need more than a minimal. And it's quite likely, I mean, as we discussed on Thursday, that the example that Ilan pointed out from our joint paper, it could be possibly a counterexample to this also. So I mean, most likely this will be wrong, but it's still, an interesting tantalizing problem. And a consequence would be, let me put it differently. The minimal assumption, this is a minimal assumption. But here, you would imagine that, I mean, if this holds, then then A has no abelian quotients.
Is that
clear? Yeah, isn't it? Because you just follow by an abelian quotient and that's not yeah.
No one-dimensional quotient.
Yeah. So you just, so if you ask that all quotients have dimension at least.
One example would be just say dimension two.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I said. There's a counterexample then, yeah. So you can make a continuous, you just use a, you make a bad prediction then somehow.
I guess it's four. If you say, it's a question of whether you talk about functions or
individuals. Yeah, so if you just look, you simply look at a continuous function over the true sphere, take a bad prediction, take a trivial prediction, and take the orthogonal sum and compress by that one. That's a counter example.
So
every irreducible representation is exactly to the limit. Yeah.
And there's
no full of that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a fact here saying that if A is weakly purely infinite and satisfies global Grimm halving, then A is purely infinite. So, you need, so this is somehow what you need in order to go from weak pure infinite to pure infiniteness. With this said, I will, the last time I have 22 minutes, I'll come to that, but I will talk a little bit about CH enterprise and about tensor products. And I'll probably even have a pretty good time for that. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Every quotient is WPR.
Yeah. And WPR may not be abelian then. It may not be finite dimension that being weakly purely infinite. That's so, yeah. I mean, so these questions about if you have C-lines about somehow who is, I mean, fat in the sense of that all quotients are, say, infinite dimensional. I mean, we know for Euler and Fourier enterprise that then it has fantastic divisibility properties. Everything you can ask for is true. But in the non Euler and Fourier case, it's completely different than Elin also pointed out on Thursday. I mean, you can have some pretty bad divisibility properties for those algebras. And I think that maybe in the old days, wasn't it true? When thought of, say, simple C algebras, infinite dimensional simple C algebras, it was somehow viewed as intrinsically, you could somehow take any kind of matrix algebra over it, roughly, and it would somehow, every corner would look, of it would look roughly like the algebra itself. I mean, I'm saying this in a slightly imprecise way. But I mean, somehow it was homogeneous. I think this is what people might expect, and this bad divisibility property somehow goes against that perception. And still, that's a slightly imprecise statement, and I think that certainly we must revise our point of view of what simple C algebras look like. But let me mention a little bit about C of X algebras and. Well, but improve this one here. It looks like it's certainly worthwhile looking it up. I mean, it seems like it was worthwhile looking that up, and it surprised me a little bit, but I mean, we're certainly happy to stick with the typical case. I mean, for sure. I mean, so I have only two things left: C of X algebras and a related topic, namely tensor products. And it's a little bit funny situation also. We have a theorem by Palanchar and Kirchberg. Saying the following, suppose that A is a C-star algebra such that the primitive ideal space of A is Hausdorff and finite dimensional. in which case it is, A is a C of X algebra, where X is this space here. Algebra, so the X being the primitive ideal space, and the fibers AX are simple. So in that case we have the following, that when A is purely infinite, if and only if each fiber is purely infinite. And what is interesting about this result is somehow that if we just change the hypothesis a little bit, it becomes open.
What about WPR?
Yeah, but I mean, these are simple, so all these notions are the same here, and this is as much as you can get. You should rather ask if it is strongly purely infinite. I mean, that would be a better question, because if it's purely infinite, it's also bigly purely infinite. Okay. And if you ask that other question, I think it is true, but I just can't say for sure. Which is not type 1?
AX.
When it's purely infinite.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what is not known, for example, is what if the dimension of X is infinite? For example, also suppose that A is a C of X algebra, with X being the Hilbert cube. Sorry. And such that AX is isomorphic to O2 for every X and X. Does it follow that A is purely infinite, and does it follow that does A absorb O2? I think the latter is actually, the latter must be wrong, the latter no. So I think that's the all want to ask. We know for sure that it cannot be, it's not necessarily O2 absorbing. We didn't, Myers observed that from our example, it follows here. So, but no, it does not imply that A absorbs O2 necessarily. Yeah, that's much more hard. We don't know about that. And that's in a way also in that question here. It's way harder. I have no idea about it. And another thing is that suppose that A is a C of X algebra, even with the dimension of X finite, is it true? Suppose that all fibers are purely infinite. Does it follow that A is purely infinite? I put this in parentheses. And one to think that maybe that isn't included in this result here, but this isn't quite, because in this result we assume the fibers to be simple. And we don't do that here. So I mean, you can say you have this nice result, but I mean, it's also striking things we don't know. And this leads me to the last 15 minutes. I will talk about tensor products. This kind of related. We have now one theorem. Most of it, this is by Kirchberg, but not all of it. We have one very nice result by Kirchberg saying the following. They're all nice, but this may be particularly nice. You probably know this well. If you have two simple theta algebras, so that A is not stably finite and B is not type 1, then it follows that the minimal tensor product, and I will also write tensor product for minimal, this is purely infinite. and simple. Simplicity follows from Takasaki's theorem. Now, what happens in the non-simple case? The following is not really a theorem, this is a statement. I just thought about it walking here, and I somehow decided it looks very promising, but I couldn't quite decide if it is quite true. Suppose now that A and B are exact, say also separable. Then A and B are traceless. Both have a non-degenerate trace, so that's the opposite of being traceless. So each of them have at least one non-degenerate trace. That happens if and only if the minimal center product has the same property. So at least in one direction it is true, if this holds, then you just take the non-degenerate trace in each freestyle algebra and take the tensor product of the traces. Look, now we have the exact case, so traces are traces, not quasi traces. Going the other way around is a little bit more tricky, but you have a pretty good idea about ideals. Basically what you need is you need an elementary tensor that behaves well and do something about that. It seems kind of promising. I believe it is true, but let me just write it in this slightly informal way. In the simple case it will be definitely, yeah. I mean, then there's absolutely no problem in the simple case.
How do you see directly in that setting that you have
I mean, it's not so hard to do. It cannot be. It must be finite somewhere if it's not dealing with trace. And it's also. It's easy enough. It's a much bigger problem in non-simple case where you really have to manipulate things and. But I think it could be a true statement. What I'm after now is somehow trying to see when can we say that the tensor product of two freestyle algebras is purely infinite in a non-simple case. And now we somehow have the negation, in some sense, having no non-degenerate trace is somehow the negation of being purely infinite, at least from some moral point of view. So here we have almost a complete answer to the question. So the question somehow should be that either A or B is traceless, somehow meaning that either A or B is purely infinite. So this somehow would lead us to the following question. I don't know what to call this. Is a wrong statement. So A and B purely infinite. Either A or B purely infinite. Is that the same as saying that the minimal center product is purely infinite? That would somehow be in spirit the same statement as this one here, assuming that being purely infinite and being traceless is the same, then it would be the same statement. But this is false in both directions. And it is because if you took the negation of this thing here, that is that A and B are both non-purely infinite, and then that would somehow be the same if they had a trace.
I mean, this
provided that all of these were the same.
You're saying that this X up there is compatible with this integer.
I mean, if purely infinite and being traceless were the same, then that would be exactly the same statement.
Okay, fine. But it seems to me in the statement you just have from your own simple case, you just look at the ideal and finiteness of some trace. And if you're opposed to, say, an ideal, if it's intersection with A and B is both zero, then doesn't it have to, the minimal tensor product doesn't even have the ideal to be zero?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something along that line you have to do. I think that it's more or less is the proof I had in mind. But I mean, I think there's a little bit more to do because I sort of felt there was a little bit more to do because you need also to go from that to a trace on each side. Anyway, but it's what I had in mind. And, right. So let me just mention some reason why this is false. If you take my example, in this direction here, so you can take A to be simple, not stably finite, but not stably, but finite, and not purely. So let me just put it like this. So I have an example not like this, and then you could take a B to be, for example, the Jiangsu algebra. Then A tensor B, the Jiangsu algebra, is purely infinite. You can see that in many ways, but you can particularly see from this result here. And neither A and B are not purely infinite. So that is in one direction that is wrong. So let me put it like this. And in the other direction, we have the following example by Kirchberg. That there exists a non-simple, non-exact, but fittable C star algebra B such that B is strongly purely infinite if you take the tensor product of B by its opposite algebra. Then that, by the way, is the same as taking the maximal tensor product by its opposite algebra, and this tensor product is not even locally purely infinite. So in this case, both of these algebras are strongly purely infinite, but their minimal tensor product is not even locally purely infinite. So that somehow shows that this is a wrong statement, but it's not more wrong than something that's true. Now let me mention, and even more could be true. Let me just get that case. So one question one might ask is, I suppose that A is exact and purely infinite. Does it follow that A tensor B is purely infinite for all C star algebras B? So supposing this, we show an exactness here, do we then have a theorem? And we could even add, what if we just take B to be the continuous function of the interval? If you could answer it in the affirmative just for this algebra here, then you would get it for B any commutative C-star algebra by some inductive limit argument. But even this one is not known. It is true, and not very hard to see, that if A is purely infinite, then A tensor the interval is PI2, and hence weakly purely infinite. So this question also relates to the question if weak pure infinite and pure infinite are the same. A theorem is a proposition, is not hard to prove. We also have some spectacular results. I'll just mention these last two results and then I'm over. By Kirchberg, that he told me about yesterday. So he has the following. Suppose that A is strongly purely infinite and that A or B is exact. then it follows that the minimal tensor product is strongly purely infinite. So this is also saying, I mean, look at this example in contrast to this thing here. I mean, you really have to alter very little. I mean, then you have a positive statement. So just in presence of exactness in one algebra and asking for strong pure infiniteness, then it behaves well. And then we have also some result of something a little bit the first theorem of Kirchberg. And that's somehow the moral of that statement, I would say, is that if you take an arbitrary C-star algebra and tensor it by another more or less arbitrary C-star algebra, then the tensor product behaves surprisingly nicely. All exotic behavior has been ruled out. I mean, that's not completely true, but it's pretty close to being true. I think at the time there's some interesting examples that show that what I just said is not quite true, but still. So this is along that line, and let me just get it right. First, suppose that A is traceless, and that B is simple, exact, and non-type 1. Then the minimal tensor product is locally purely infinite. So we get from tracelessness to local purely infinite by just by tensoring by any algebra like this. We can then go on and say, suppose that A is locally purely infinite and that B is as before, then A tensor B now is strongly purely infinite. And if you combine these two statements, we get the following, that if A is traceless, and if B1 and B2 both are as above, then we conclude that A minimal tensor product B1, minimal tensor product B2 is strongly purely infinite. So again, if you look at this whole sequence of things, going from tracelessness to strong pure infiniteness is guaranteed if you just tensor twice by algebras with a simple exact and non-type 1. It's an open problem if you need only do it once here. I mean, Eberhard could not quite decide that. It seems like it probably should be the case, but his machine didn't give it right away. So I guess that is another question. So it is time, and I will stop my lecture about purely infinite C-star algebras here.